The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. Today we're going to talk about Dogen's chapter on giving rise to the enlightened mind. Reverend Master Hubert's notes say that this talk was given on the same day as the talk we had yesterday, and that this talk was probably mostly meant for monks, and yesterday's talk mostly meant for lay trainees, but I think both of them are good for all of us. And so all of us are here for both of them. This chapter is about the Bodhisattva vow. Dogen says, generally speaking, there are three types of mind. The first is the mind of citta, which we call the discriminative mind. Somewhere else, Rav Master Hubert distinguishes between the discriminative mind, i.e. the mind that needs to find its way around and evaluate things to know what is food and what is compost, and the discriminatory mind, the mind of judgments and opinions. Of course, they're related, but there is a difference in the attitude of mind. Rather than think food is good, compost is bad, we might think food is appropriate to eat, compost is appropriate for the garden, and leave it at that. It's a difference in how we see things, but we still need to discern one thing from another, obviously. It goes on, the second mind is the mind of Hridaya, which we call the mind of grass and trees. The third is the mind of Vrida, which we call the true mind. But I looked up these last two and I couldn't find anything terribly helpful in the way of definition, so I'll leave them be, not complicate things. So we've got the mind of citta, the mind of Hridaya, the mind of Vrida. And I don't think Dogen meant that these are all separate minds. He doesn't think that way. And yesterday he made it very clear that it's all one mind. But he's got a point here. He says, among these, we invariably employ the discriminative mind, citta, to arise bodhicitta, the enlightened mind. Discriminative wisdom that knows that this is good to do. He says, Bodhi is an Indian word which we call the way or what is true. Or sometimes it's called enlightenment, Bodhi. Citta is an Indian word which we call the discriminative mind. And without this discriminative mind, we could not give rise to the enlightened mind. He says, I'm not saying that this discriminative mind is the enlightened mind. Rather, we give rise to the enlightened mind by means of the discriminative mind. But they're not separate from minds. They're all one thing, but one gives rise to the other. One comes forth, grows from the other. They're not separate. Bodhicitta, sometimes seen as the mind that seeks the way, the mind of enlightenment, the mind of the Bodhisattva. So now Dogen now explains what giving rise to the enlightened mind means. It means the Bodhisattva vow. And as we go on in this chapter, we need to bear this in mind. When he talks about the enlightened mind, he's talking about the Bodhisattva vow. Giving rise to the enlightened mind not only means vowing to take all sentient beings across to the other shore before one has taken oneself across, but it also means actively engaging in the task. Though somebody may be considered lowly, when such a one gives rise to this mind, that person is already a spiritual guide and teacher for all sentient beings. So we note that giving rise to this vow doesn't mean that one is enlightened. It means that one is practicing enlightenment, actively engaging in the task. It doesn't mean we're completely enlightened. But actively engaging in the task, not just thinking about it. Oh, how nice to save all beings before I save myself. Oh, yes, that sounds very nice. But we have to actively engage in the task. If we were enlightened, if we were a Buddha, this is how we would be behaving. This is what we'd be doing. Helping all beings reach the other shore before we go there ourselves. This is practicing enlightenment, practicing the way of the Buddha. To realize enlightenment, make it real, put it into practice. And we can do this. And who knows? We may have made this vow in ages past, maybe many times. If we feel a kind of recognition, a sense of, yes, I want to do this, it may be so, I don't know. It's possible that we have already made this vow many times in the past. This mind is neither something innate nor something that suddenly rises up as new at this moment, nor is it something singular or something plural, nor is it something spontaneous or something planned, nor is it something within our physical body, nor is our body something within that mind. This mind is not something that has permeated the entire universe of thoughts and things, nor is it something of the past or something of the future, nor is it something that is present or something that is absent, nor is it something intrinsic or something produced by an external cause, nor is it something of a combined nature or something of a causeless nature. It's not this and it's not that. It's not something else. We can't grab hold of it. Dogen's always doing this. It's not this, it's not that, it's not the other thing. Sometimes it's completely the opposite of what he said yesterday, you know. And yet, he's trying to get us to relinquish our grip on some idea of what something is, grabbing hold of it, defining it, putting it in a box. He does not want us to do that. So he's constantly saying, it's not this, it's not that, it's not the other thing. And yes, it's within all these things, it's part of all these things, and it's not them, and they're not it, and yet they are. It's just to kind of shake us loose from our grip. Even so, he says, at that point, when we have established a spiritual connection with the Master, we give rise to the mind that aspires for enlightenment. Once again, he's talking about making a spiritual connection with the Master. And as you said, we tend to take this, or I tend to take it, not literally, but rather meaning making a commitment to a particular path of training. When we find our path of training, we need to commit ourselves to it, and we give rise to the mind that aspires for enlightenment, the mind that seeks the way, the bodhisattva mind. Something in us knows that this is the right way for us to go. And Dogen goes on, it is not something that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas conferred upon us, nor is it something that we can do for ourselves. This mind arises due to its being established through a spiritual connection with our Master, and consequently, it is not something spontaneous. This isn't a kind of fatalism, either I have a spiritual connection or I don't. We have to nourish it. We have a choice. But in fact, we already have the spiritual connection, or we wouldn't be here. Most people wouldn't want to be here. Most people aren't here. Most people don't even see the way here. There is something that has called us here. We already have the mind that aspires for enlightenment, the mind of the Bodhisattva. We just need to keep cultivating it, putting it into practice, practicing the Bodhisattva vow. After giving rise to the enlightenment-seeking mind, one does the training and practice for 3 asamkhaya eons, or for 100 great eons. Well, Reverend Master Hubert's comforting little footnote reminds us that this doesn't mean that training takes thousands and millions of years. It just takes as long as it takes Otherwise, no one would ever start. Who wants to train for thousands and millions of asamkhya years in the faint hope of doing a little better? You would never do it. It would be too discouraging. And Bodhidharma says the same thing, actually. He says, don't worry about training taking so long that you're exhausted even thinking about it. Just do it, and don't worry about it. Time is a human concept. Things can take a really long time, and it may seem like just a minute. Sometimes something seems like it just takes a minute. It's a long time. The mind that seeks the way is the mind of boundlessness, no limits, no conditions. I'll do it no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes. And the training is the practice of enlightenment itself. It's not a preparation for something we will get later on. We are putting it into practice, making it real, right now. As Dogen says, in some cases, people train for immeasurable eons and then become a Buddha. In other cases, people train for immeasurable eons to help sentient beings reach the other shore, ultimately not becoming a Buddha, but just continuing to help ferry sentient beings across, doing this solely for the benefit of sentient beings. They are pursuing the course that is the delight of bodhisattvas. He goes on, to speak more broadly, the mind of enlightenment operates via the three modes of behavior, body, speech, and mind, without a moment's idleness, always helping sentient beings give rise to the mind of enlightenment and leading them along the Buddha's way. To waste one's time bestowing worldly pleasures on people does not benefit sentient beings. Giving rise to this mind and giving rise to this training for the enlightenment of others go far beyond the outer bounds of delusion versus enlightenment. It's limitless, boundless, it's unconditional. We kind of fling ourselves out into the unknown. Well, why not? What else are we going to do? We might as well fling ourselves out into the unknown. Practice the enlightened mind, the bodhisattva path. Awakening one's intention and arriving at the ultimate, though two, are not separate. Of these two states of mind, the former is the more difficult to arrive at. This is Mahakashyapa speaking to the Buddha. It's harder to awaken one's intention to seek enlightenment than to actually get there. To start is harder in some ways than to keep going. To have this opportunity, even to hear of the three treasures, is a rare and wonderful opportunity. And now we have it. So we've started, and we're on the way. So be encouraged. The arising of the intention means giving rise right off to the intention to help others reach the other shore, even though you yourself have not yet reached that place. We call this giving rise to the enlightened mind for the first time. Once you have given rise to this mind, you will then encounter Buddhas, to whom you should make alms offerings, and you should hearken to their teaching. Further, should you then strive to give rise to the enlightened mind, it will be like adding frost atop snow. Once you've given rise to this mind, we'll encounter Buddhas who will help us. We'll receive help along the way. May not be literally, but we'll find help along the way with our faith in the three treasures. Once we've given rise to this mind, and having done so, we don't need to keep trying to give rise to it, striving to do that. We've already done that. We just need to trust it, nourish it, keep going. Even the Buddha says, in the scripture on the immeasurable life of the Tathagata, which we actually chant quite often here, he says, I constantly make this my intention. How may I help living beings enter the unsurpassed way and quickly realize Buddhahood? Constantly making this his intention. This is why the Buddha's life is immeasurable. He's still doing it. He's still helping beings, giving rise to the intention, doing the training and practice, and awakening to the fruits of Buddhahood are the same for all Buddhas. It's the same training as it is for us. And Dogen says, even though our light, our little light, the light of our first giving rise to the intention to help and train beings, is like the light of a firefly compared with the huge blazing light of the Buddha's wisdom. Really, he says, there's no difference between the two. It's still the light of Buddha. Our little light, our little aspiration, seemingly small, is still the light of Buddha. It's not different. It has the same nature. We just trust it and nourish it. And he says, having made this bodhisattva vow, we need to hold to it. He says, don't think you'll become a Buddha simply because of your ability to help others reach the other shore. Even if the ripening of your merit was enough to turn you into a Buddha, still you should offer this merit to sentient beings in order to help them realize Buddhahood and recognize the truth. So even if we have enough merit to become a Buddha right off, offer the merit to others. Give it away. So what does the bodhisattva vow actually mean for us? It sounds wonderful, limitless, and it is. But how do we practice it? Putting it simply, by relinquishing selfishness. Not just thinking of ourselves and our affairs and our states of mind, but seeing other beings who could do with a little help and kindness. Small, simple, seeing other people. Thinking of them, practicing sympathy, kindness. The Jataka tales, if you've read them, they're the stories of the Buddha's lives before he was Shakyamuni Buddha. And there's all sorts of stories about some great sacrifice, feeding one's body to a starving tigress, giving one's life to save others. Wonderful, inspiring stories of the Buddha's life as a bodhisattva before he became a Buddha. And there's a really good lesson in these, lots of good lessons in them, the willingness to give oneself completely. But really, most of our practice of unselfishness is a lot more mundane. We don't have to look for starving tigers, just as well. We can simply practice kindness, take time with people, we keep saying this, not just rush around bent on our own affairs. Take time with people. Just not thinking of, not getting so wrapped up in ourself that we don't notice the person next to us on the bus or in the line at the checkout stand. We don't have to have a whole conversation with them, but just to be aware that they're there. Maybe offer a little merit. You might see somebody looking kind of down, you know, passing a person who's homeless. Not just to avert one's eyes and hurry by, but give them something, or even better, give them a kind word. You know, how are you doing? You know, some mark of respect that we know that we're just the same as them. Not to have a kind of patronizing attitude. I will graciously spend time with this person. But really remembering that we're just the same as everyone else. We're no different. We're all one body. This is why we practice the bodhisattva vow, because we are all one body. Constantly, in little ways, we practice this vow, not one grand gesture. You may have a grand gesture called for. You might have somebody drowning, I mean, leap in at the river to rescue them and so forth. It doesn't happen often. But mostly it's just those little ways in which we can be aware of the other human beings. Not always on our phone, you know, walking down the street with our head down, not seeing who's around us or whatever we might be doing. Paying attention, being there with people. We also don't make martyrs of ourselves. We need to treat ourselves kindly too. Take care of ourselves as well. The Buddha made this very clear. We're not special. We're not the center of everything. And we shouldn't disregard ourselves either. To respect our body and mind and our life and be grateful for them, because they're the means by which we train, not to treat ourselves as different, to treat ourselves as we treat others, to treat them as we treat ourselves or as we'd wish to be treated. Kindness to everybody, ourselves included, nothing separate, nothing different, nothing special, nothing grand necessarily, just ordinary, modest little ways of practicing our bodhisattva vow. Dogen goes on. This mind is not ours, or someone else's, or something that comes to us. Yet after this intention arises, whenever we raise aloft the great earth, everything turns into gold. And whenever we sprinkle the waters of the great ocean, they immediately turn into the sweet dew. After that, whenever we lay hold of soil or rocks, sand or pebbles, we make use of this enlightened mind. And whenever we explore the gushing forth of water and the blazing up of fire, we are personally shouldering the enlightened mind. Hence, to offer as alms one's nation and city, one's spouse and children, the seven treasures, men and women, one's head and eyes, one's marrow and brains, one's body and flesh, or one's hands and feet, all are the hustle and bustle of an enlightened mind. All are an enlightened mind's playfulness, which is like a fish frolicking in a pool of water. Whatever we're doing, raising aloft the great earth, sprinkling the waters of the great ocean, or just working with soil and rocks and pebbles, doing mundane tasks, in all of it, we make use of this enlightened mind, the gushing forth of water and the blazing up of fire. It's beautiful, it's lovely. The offering. As we said yesterday, we offer everything because none of it is ours. None of it is separate from anything else. Our body and flesh, nation and city, men and women, spouse and children, the seven treasures, they're all part of everything else. We're not giving away our family, as we said. We give ourselves completely and joyfully. None of it is ours, but we offer everything of our life with joy, like a fish frolicking in a pool of water, without fear, without worry, without clinging, without holding back, without saying, this is mine, I can't part with any of this, but entrusting everything to the three treasures, entrusting our children to the Buddhas. We can't keep hold of them, they get in trouble, they make their mistakes. We have to let them live their lives. None of it is ours. No people, no things, our own body and mind are not our own. They're just that which is lent to us temporarily to make use of, to help us on our way, do our training. And giving all these things away doesn't mean acting foolishly or abandoning our responsibilities or not making some grand gesture. We still need to use our discriminative wisdom. As I said, our practice of the bodhisattva vow is usually quite mundane and seemingly ordinary. But to maintain this mind of selflessness, of not seeing oneself as the most important thing, is not that easy, actually. Ceaseless practice, constantly coming back to stillness, seeing other beings, practicing the four wisdoms, charity, benevolence, tenderness, and sympathy. They're all ways of relating to others, the four wisdoms. Constantly coming back to this. Dogen now goes on to talk at some length about the arising and vanishing of all things. Everything arises and passes away at each moment. This is hard to understand. I don't really understand it. And even Dogen admits it's hard to understand. So I won't go into it. I won't even try. But the point is, this arising and vanishing of everything at each moment leads us to impermanence. If it were not so, things could not change and we could not change if things didn't arise and pass away all the time. Well, we see things arising and passing away, but this arising and passing away at each instant, at each moment, is hard to see. And yet, Dogen says, even if we don't see it, we can trust that it is so. And because of impermanence, because the cycle of birth and death rolls on without stopping, even for a single moment, as Dogen says, with our body and mind rolling on like this, through the cycle of birth and death, we should immediately give rise to the enlightened intention of helping others reach the other shore, even though we ourselves have not yet reached that place. As we simply give rise to enlightened mind, even if we regret having a body and mind, they are what arises, ages, sickens, and dies, and ultimately they are not our possession. Oh, how unceasingly and swiftly sentient beings go through life from arising to vanishing. Don't waste time. This fleeting life is precious for ourselves and others. So we do our best to help others reach the other shore. And Dogen quotes a parable of the Buddha when somebody asks the Buddha, at what speed does the course of a being's life from its arising to its departing go? The Buddha replied, although I could tell you, you would not understand. The person then asked, is there some example that could illustrate it? The Buddha said, there is, and I shall tell it to you now for your benefit. Consider, for example, four fine archers. Each takes up his bow and arrow, then the four, standing together back to back, prepare to shoot in the direction each is facing. Now there is a nimble man who comes along and says to them, now if you will all shoot off your arrows at the same time, I will be able to catch them all before any of them touch the ground. What do you think? Would such a one be nimble or not? The person said to the Buddha, he will be exceedingly swift, O world-honored one. The Buddha then said, the swiftness of that man is not as fast as that of an earth-dwelling yaksha, some kind of a belligerent demon who enjoys stirring things up. And he gives all these examples. And a yaksha isn't as fast as someone else, and they're not as fast as the celestial beings, and they're not as fast as someone else. And none of these are as fast as the course of a being's life. The course of a being, living being's life from its rising to its departing passes swifter still. It rolls on in every moment without the slightest pause. The swiftness with which the cycle of arising and vanishing rolls on in every moment during the course of our life, The swiftness with which the cycle of arising and vanishing rolls on in every moment during the course of our life is like this. You who are doing the practice instant by instant, pray, do not forget this principle. While you are experiencing the swiftness with which the cycle of arising and vanishing rolls on in every moment during the course of your life, if you give rise to a single thought of helping others arrive before you yourself have done so, the life that is eternal will manifest before your very eyes, says Dogen. The life that is eternal. We're still within birth and death. Our life arises and vanishes very, very quickly, as Dogen and the Buddha have pointed clearly to us. We're still within birth and death, and it all takes place within the great life of Buddha, the life that is eternal. Zen is eternal life. It doesn't mean that we're eternal, but we are part of the eternal life of Buddha. And Dogen says, all the Buddhas and ancestors have maintained and relied on this enlightened mind. Thus it is that even though there are those who remain in home life and those who have left home life behind, i.e. both lay people and monks, and even though there are those who are in lofty positions and those who are just ordinary folk, and even though there are those who say that they are suffering and those who say that they are happy, all should quickly give rise to the intention of helping others awaken before they themselves have fully awakened. Even though the world of sentient beings has its limits and is also beyond limits, we give rise, first off, to the intention of helping all sentient beings awaken, for this is what the enlightened mind is. the world of sentient beings has its limits and is also beyond limits. It's both. Interesting. After we have given rise to the enlightened mind, we must not regress or wander off from it, but must steadfastly protect and defend it. The Buddha once said, how do bodhisattvas protect the one great matter, which is enlightened mind? The bodhisattvas and mahasattvas are always diligent in protecting enlightened mind, which is like ordinary parents in the world protecting their child, or like a one-eyed person protecting his one remaining eye, or like someone protecting his guide when going through a wilderness. A bodhisattva's protecting enlightened mind is just like this. Because bodhisattvas rely on safeguarding enlightened mind in this way, they realize supreme, fully perfected enlightenment. Because they rely on realizing supreme, fully perfected enlightenment, they come equipped with certainty, right-mindedness, self-worth, and freedom from defilement, which describes the unsurpassed great nirvana. For this reason, bodhisattvas protect this one teaching. They have certainty, right-mindedness, self-worth, and freedom from defilement. All these things are good to consider. Because, generally speaking, there are many who have regressed and thereby have forgotten enlightened mind, forgotten their bodhisattva vow. Dogen says, because generally speaking there are many who have regressed and thereby have forgotten enlightened mind, I too once feared that I would regress and forget it. This is why I have protected enlightened mind. It is precious, it is our guide, our eye that sees the way through the wilderness. We need to protect it and nourish it. Protect and nourish our bodhisattva vow, ceaselessly putting it into practice. And Dogen says, O my bodhisattvas, you should not regress or wander away from your vow to practice helping others to awaken before awakening yourself. We nourish our bodhisattva vow simply by practicing it, relinquishing our self-partiality, seeing others as like ourselves, practicing the four wisdoms, seeing others as part of ourselves, nothing separate, nothing different, nothing greater, nothing smaller, no bounds, no limits. We are all part of the life of Buddha. This is our bodhisattva vow. This is giving rise to the enlightened mind. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.